Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 207, Flow States with Dr. Mark Epstein.
Buddhist scientific / philosophical thing that the only definitive meaning teaching is a pure negation.
Mm-hmm. Explain what that
because,
what do you mean?
Because negative cognition is always open-ended. When you know there's no elephant, it's like you never really come, you don't find the non-elephant. You never do. You just don't find the elephant. And you develop a tolerance for that not inability to find it.
Mm.
And that's the only definitive theory or whatever it is this kind of pure negation.
Mm-hmm.
That all seemingly getting or capturing or fitting in or making sense type of explanations are only relative, which doesn't mean they're utterly invalid within their context.
Mm-hmm.
But it means they can't be attributed like some sort of absolute power. And one is always open to further experience to revise, you know, something like that. But within the relative descriptions of processes and things, there are better and worse, for
right,
sure.
Right, of course.
Yeah, you know, that doesn't crush. People are so used in the West to absolutist type of theories that they feel that relativist theory will be nihilistic and will be crazy and will provide no control, you know, because they're so insecure. They want to have daddy controlling everything 100%. But, and then you get dogmas and extremism and fanaticism and things like that. So what these brilliant people are saying is just completely like that. It's amazing.
I think for the issue, you know, the addiction, anxiety, depression, like that, what Adam Phillips is getting at is that the thing that's driving a lot of that is that incomplete feeling, that sort of vengefulness of, you know, like, I never got enough kind of thing. And so there's this reaching for something that will complete the picture. And then in the Buddhist emphasis on exploration of the self and understanding selflessness, this ability to keep it open, what Bob was just talking about, the pure negation as the, you know, like not getting it, you know, but keeping the field open so that we're looking all the time and curious all the time, but not fixating on any one aspect of who we think we are, who we have to be.
But on the other hand, there's a kind of razor's edge.
Yeah.
Where there's a kind of resignation that can set in that itself is a kind of getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an attachment to, okay, I don't know anything. And
yes.
And then, the thing about the negation of emptiness or selflessness, that type of thing, is that that is the result of having totally, absolutely put the absolute desire to get and to know and then have it sort of expand into the openness rather than pull back. For example,
yes.
Descartes, when he was seeking the self, he admitted defeat that he couldn't find it. And so he didn't push ahead into that, or he didn't not find the not finding or something, if you want to put it something like that. So what he did was he said, oh, well, I didn't find it because I was looking for it as an object, but actually it's my subjectivity. So therefore, I'm absolutely certain about my subjectivity. So then cogito, ergo sum. was an absolute point of certainty for him. You know, in other words, he didn't push further where even the certainty of uncertainty was not clear or something like that. I can't explain it. And he did it because he didn't have an analyst. Or I usually say, actually, except for today, he didn't have a lama or a roshi or a good one, not like some idiot, but a good one to whom would give a kind of feedback like, now you're all back and happy about how absolute you are because you've defined yourself out of having to be found. But actually, you, without realizing or considering yourself still a real object that you possess. So someone else couldn't kind of give him that reflection back. Mm-hmm. So then he set us off for three centuries of nonsense. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't have the analyst. Mm. So Vipassana is analysis. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's the supreme meditation too, not shamatha.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can be. The Nazis are one-pointed about their stupid swastika or their like ridiculous hat with the weird thing or their dumb gun.
Right.
You know, they're absolute about it. So that openness is something different, right?
Mm.
I think. What do you think?
I think, yeah.
Did you say you have been guilty of being in a flow state?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to say guilty as in a bad thing, but like I get in that state a lot, and like I notice myself getting out of like whatever like low energy, low vibrational feeling I may be feeling, if I'm just like in the flow, so to speak.
Right. So, but the being guilty about being in the flow is a post-flow state interpretation of where actually where you were, where you are. And so that's like the what we were looking at when we a little bit discussed about the seeking of the self, with the meditation on selflessness being a seeking of the self. And then when one seeks it with full determination and total curiosity and doesn't withdraw on some rationalization of like, well, that's impossible to find, and like, you know, that's a subject and an object, like all these kind of like dodges. Then things do disappear, and then one disappears, and that's a kind of flow. That's a release, a feeling of release of disappearing, and then there's a return, and then the key, then the interpretation of what the disappearance was, becomes a very very key thing, and then in that context, in that tradition, the ideal is where the two, there's like an oscillation back and forth, for some period of time. And then there is the goal state, the goal, so to speak, is to be in the flow in such a way that one can also be functioning within a non-flow or a non-disappeared way. So it appeared and disappeared at the same time, in other words, something like that, which then sounds inconceivable. And but that would seem to be the goal. And then, and yet, like by the analogy of the mirror, there seems to be a path for exceptional persons, actually, in that tradition, who can come somehow encompass that cognitive dissonance sort of through inference, actually, through kind of openness and through encompassing the, seeing the nature of the paradox and not collapsing it in either way and upholding being on that razor's edge. And that kind of person can proceed more quickly, they say. So that seems to be the challenge. That's what it reminds me. So that's good. Being guilty of having been in the flow state is really being guilty of not still being in it, in a way. And so then there is the thing of, well, not to say, well, the flow was a delusion, and this is a delusion, and somehow this picking and choosing on either of the two sides is the delusion, something like that. Then there is a kind of hope of unifying it. And then that sounds impossible, but we totally do it. When you get up in the morning and look at your face in the mirror, for whatever, you know, an eyebrow or whatever it is, for a male it's like scratching away or whatever we do, and it's like you see left as right and right as left, but you don't think twice. You don't have, in a way, you could say it's unconscious that you're corrected completely. Mm. And then they have that psychological experiment. I never did it. I've always wanted to do it. where you put on a certain glass, a certain kind of lens, and then if you first, for a short time, you see everything upside down, but then your brain flips it over within a short period of time.
Yeah.
I would love to do that. I never had that flip feeling. I never had that lens. I should go to some lab somewhere and have some guy do it. But, so it's unconscious, but in a way, it's also, it's a level of, you could say, corrected intuition, that you don't have to think, oh, this is a mirror, it's a delusion, it looks like a three-dimensional space over there through a window, but it isn't, and then somehow left and right gets reversed, and I'll correct that, and so when I want to put the, correct the eyeliner on my eyebrow on my right side, I will put it on the left side. So you don't have to go through that whole thing, because it's a level of knowing that is not knowing. It's a knowing that's already, you know, fitted together, something like that.
Yeah.
So that's obviously your task. The guilt is good. It prods you to work on it.
The thing you're saying about play, I think, is interesting in relationship to what we're talking about meditation. Because I always think of meditation as a kind of transitional experience, in the way that Winnicott talks about as the infant, you know, grows away from the mother, he or she usually attaches to some kind of precious blanket or wiggle worm. Or teddy bear, or or the mother's T-shirt, or something that Winnicott called a transitional object. And one of the characteristics of the transitional object is that it has a special status. It's not the child. It's not the mother. It's not me, but it's not me. It's holding this space. And Winnicott makes a lot of that, and talks about how that experience of the transitional object grows into what he calls transitional experiencing of all kinds, with play being the first, because his ideal of a child playing is that he or she knows that the mother is, you know, in the next room, that the umbrella of her attention is still with the child, but she's not interfering. So there's enough space for the child to begin to have a sense of his, her, or her own continuation of being, a sort of ongoing flow, like you were talking about, that where the child's lost in play, but also very present in play. So the book I wrote called Going on Being, that's taken from Winnicott, from his description of that. And I always think of the breath or mindfulness or bare attention in some way as being like a transitional object, in that we're moving from the, a fixed relationship of ourselves to ourselves to a separation from that, into a mysterious area that we don't really know. But that field that we're setting up is sort of like the holding environment that the mother sets up for the infant and then gradually releases her into.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallows. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast with Dr. Mark Epstein. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at the annual Buddhism and Psychotherapy Weekend Retreat held at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York. to learn more about this yearly program held in the heart of the Catskills with Robert Thurman and Dr. Mark Epstein, please visit menla.us. Continuing education credits are available upon request. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including discounts on tuition at programs in New York City and at Menla Retreat in Dewa Spa in upstate New York, please visit tibethouse.us. As a Tibet House U.S. monthly supporter, you'll also receive special VIP invites to events with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and special invites to Dossett tours with Robert Thurman led by Geographic Expedition to pilgrimage sites around the world. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. If becoming a monthly member isn't an option for you, please be sure to subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Every share, like, and comment helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Your online participation here at the Bob Thurman Podcast and online on social media and on the Tibet House US YouTube channel helps make a difference. Every like, comment, and share there helps spread the word about Tibet House's mission. Thanks for your support online. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. Poetry for the Bob Thurman Podcast is read by Gary Gock. This week, Gary reads a poem by the classic poet Wallace Stevens. Hope you enjoy. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Professor Thurman and Dr. Mark Epstein.
You know, what I'm thinking is that, from what you said, it could well be that the flow state is the human nature, that all humans are supposed to be in a flow state all the time. And that all of the, if their interactions and actions were, in a sense, as, you know, part of a flow state, then that's, a flow state is like a love state. And then the feeling of freedom and blissfulness of being in a flow state would be automatically the sort of the woof, or the woof, I can never remember which is a woof and which is a warp and a woof. Who knows? But it would be like the texture of the fabric of interaction between beings. And Wilhelm Reich's thing of orgone energy is like connected to that, and his concept of the emotional plague. Because then the emotional plague is then a person is conditioned because of violence and militarism, actually, which expands into militarism and violence in the family, is conditioned to shut off their inner sensitivity and their, what he called, I think, inner sense of streaming, where the orgone energy is in a, is a flow state. And then, and only contacting the brief section, brief segment of life, approved sensuality, you know, like the mini orgasm of the procreative orgasm that is only one is allowed to have, type of thing. And then that person who's in that emotional plague state is feels very left out, very much wants to get it, wants to get out of there, but they can't feel it internally. So then they become sadistic, they become more violent, they spread, and then he has this brilliant thing where they feel threatened that they're going to be dissolved, or their sense of control and separation and safe separation is going to be dissolved by when they encounter someone who is in a flow state. And therefore, what they're really afraid of is themselves feeling a streaming that would feel that would threaten their sense of fixed structure with which they're shooting the world and defending themselves with their armor and their whole thing. And so they go to strangle and to destroy that representative or node of the flow state. In his case, he called it the murder of Christ. You know, the murder of a being that is a channel of the natural energy of life. So instead of being guilty about being in a flow state, you should be guilty for not being in a flow state, obviously. If that's so. And the other thing is that Menla, my wife, when we were given Menla to make a medicine Buddha healing place for people in this emotionally plagued nation and planet at the moment on some level, she had the idea that people, when the minute they entered the gate, they should feel relieved and to some whatever degree they're capable of. So that's like our motive, you know, is that Menla should be. That's what Menla's motive is. Mm-hmm. That's what the Buddha's motive is. And the problem being, you see, that if you go up to the emotional plague person, and this comes back to the thing about, we had this conversation yesterday, if you go up to the emotional plague person, you in the flow state, and them desperately wanting to be, but afraid when they feel anything like that, and then immediately wanting to be violent, to shut it down, subliminally knowing that they're getting the vibe of it, you know, then you can expect that it won't work. It's like you go up to give a paranoiac a huge hug, and they perceive a being that's coming to consume them or destroy them or something, and so they'll just fight it off. And that's Buddha's problem. When the Buddha attained Buddhahood, or any of the people, millions of people since, they see other beings as potentially flowing and fine. And they're frustrated, that their frustration, from which compassion comes, is they know they can't just somehow blast them into being cooled out. You know, they can't. And so those people themselves have to try to mobilize curiosity to get out of their prison. They have to mobilize, they want to get something better than where they are, and they have to have that motivation. And so that's why they say the greatest gift there is teaching. You giving of material things, giving of security, are the two other kinds, the main types of giving. But the greatest kind of giving is the giving of teaching. Because the giving of true teaching, you know, teaching that leads to that. Because teaching enables the person themselves to find their own nature, type of thing. And that's why I'm saying, inspired by Dr. Mark, that it is psychoanalysis from thousands of years ago. It is the beginning of psychoanalysis, actually. Totally. And every Dharma student should be a psychoanalyst, should train to be a psychoanalyst. That's in this country. That's the only thing to do, I think. Don't you think?
I do think.
What? You agree?
I agree.
You ready to train them?
Yeah.
Educate them?
Yeah.
Well, I've been thinking about it in nuclear detonation.
Yeah.
You know, the nuclear cloud, you know, mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
And the whole planet is anyone even who saw the picture, it was a major lesson in impermanence.
Yeah.
Although Truman should not be forgiven that he didn't drop it in the bay in front of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why he dropped it on the people is beyond. But, you know, you can show it by, like, then there's some fish, it's sad for the fish, but it's not that some poor people scrabbling around in the kimono trying to have some, like, have some sushi. And but that is the teaching, that there is there is infinite energy in the very atoms of our body. Chain reaction means if Kim Jong-un or his pal Trump, with the two competing hairdos, if they were to drop a bomb near here, what would vaporize us is the chain reaction of our own molecules, cells, and atoms, and subatomic particles would release this infinite energy in a way that our tissues and things could not withstand. and we would be vaporized, right? If we were lucky enough to be within the blast horizon or whatever it's called. And so everybody realized impermanence, what's called subtle impermanence, subliminally. Everyone did when those things went off, you know, and when you see them and when you sort of vaguely hear about the theory, you know, E equals mc squared, you know. You know, m is mass. C squared is the square root, square of 186,000. That's a big amount of numbers. So, you know, that, we all know that. Everyone knows that we're massively impermanent and we're frightened about it, of course, completely. And then the people with them who can't bear the flow state because they're afraid of their own streaming, they're like desperately flailing around, you know. And they really are the objects of our compassion, 100%. But compassion is, upaya has to be manifest as something called upaya. And I don't mean the Zen Center in Santa Fe, although hopefully it's working on that. But upaya means something like a strategy, or even a trick. It can mean a trick, it can mean a strategy. I say what it really means is art. You know, art, you know, you have arts and sciences. Arts and sciences doesn't just mean the arts part is not just somebody doing a painting or making a sculpture. It means also engineers, you know, doctors, you know, anything that you do skillfully to try to help beings. So compassion has to be artful, and it is not artful to flow state your way up to some guy with like an AK-47 and like a weird helmet and a Nazi flag and a goofy look on his face, and usually his. I think there were no females in that mob, I think, right? I don't think so. Maybe there were some who were rooting them on who were, like, confused, but I don't think there are any out there, actually. They wouldn't have allowed that. That would have freaked them out. Would have been distracted them from their fear, you know. Is that okay?
That's good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's nice. So anyway, I'm still having the bomb is still going off, you know.
Go
That's
ahead.
Very important.
Yeah.
That means you have infinite energy in all of your cells. That's why you had a good sleep last night. So you feel better. We all have this infinite energy. It can be destructive if it's released unskillfully. But imagine what we can tap into gently. You know? Nobody is short of energy. Every subatomic particle in there is like ready to like create a mushroom cloud over the town. Part of a chain reaction. We're all interconnected. I read something on Quora. I like Quora. And I know I'm coming to the question, but I'm sorry, I'm just, let me share this. And in Quora, they said that speed of light in the Einstein thing is only the speed of light in a vacuum. It's exactly 186,000 miles per second in a vacuum. But that means that it's always a little slower, luckily, in ourselves, where we resist, we're not quite a vacuum, supposedly. But on the other hand, you know, speed of light as an absolute, you know, it is the non-relative thing in Einstein's thing, you know, speed of light, that nothing can go faster. Because why? Because something that moves faster than that, their mass becomes infinite. In other words, if they go faster, they're everywhere. But that's like the clear light.
Mm.
So that means that at a sort of essential level, we are all everywhere, too. And what I want, and what this connects to, I'm sorry, please hold the question, but I'll come back to it. What this comes into is the Heart Sutra that we chanted. And everything we've touched on this morning, I think, is this. And it has to do with where we are located, ultimately. What is our ultimate reality? In a way, we're all ultimately located in a vacuum, in the void, you know. But the void, since speed of light goes through the void at the speed where mass becomes infinite, that place, rather than a place of demolition or destruction, is a place of omnipresence. So, time also, beginningless and endless. Space, infinite. There's some nonsense they think, oh, Big Bang came out of nowhere, and then it's just running away from us. All those planets, they're redshifting their way. They must be communists. They're redshifting away from us, and they're running away. And then, of course, beyond that, there's nothing. So we counted, there's a total number, and therefore, thank goodness, we're not in infinity. But of course we are in infinity, And because we can't exclude infinity, because infinity wouldn't be infinite if it was not us. So we all are infinite, actually. And therefore, everything we do is play. We make a mistake taking it too seriously. In some way, we haven't gotten over the world or ourselves. And therefore, in an infinite past, infinite numbers of beings, just like us, have become perfect Buddhas. And infinite numbers of them can go into samadhis, and they can go into the profound illumination, and then Avalokiteshvaras among us will feel like heart sutra, they'll think everything is empty, and matter is voidness is matter, and then some Shariputras will be consternated, but they'll want to know what's going on. And so there is a field, we're all a vast field, and what is that field? And that's why Buddha was happy, and that's why we can doubt and be curious, and we can play, and we can be in flow and not in flow, because we're held, we are ourselves holding this field. And this is the nirvana field. And it's already, we're holding it already. And we just have these veils and these obscurations that block us from enjoying it fully. And we feel nervous to be there, and therefore, but yet we know that that's more realistic to be in that state, and therefore we feel guilty when we're not, but on the other hand, we feel safer when we're not, on the other hand. Because nobody, it seems like nobody else is, this kind of thing. But the key thing is, we are Buddha felt, and that this thing comes back to your faith thing. Yeah. And it's not faith in some omnipotent thing that's going to take care of it for us, because actually we are it. And that's a heresy. That's the pantheistic heresy in theism. They burn you at the stake for that one. That's a dangerous one in a bunch of uptight, Republicans, racists, or whatever they're, or could be religious fanatics, but it doesn't matter. It's somebody who's got something they hide behind that makes them exclude other beings, right? So this is the thing. This field is this great field. It's a good field. It's perfect. There's nothing wrong with it. And this, in other words, the Heart Sutra we chant, there's incountless numbers of enlightened beings who have, and they didn't leave us behind. They're not in some other world. They're not dead. They're here. We're held in their mind, and their mind is one with our mind. So we're also holding it together, holding ourselves together. And that means that we are holding ourselves together when there's a centripetal or fugal, which is the one that flings out.
Fugal.
Every subatomic particle of our thing has an infinite centrifugal energy, which is released in the chain reaction released by the theory of hate, a nuclear explosion, chain reaction of hatred. So love is more powerful than me. So relax. People never die, They don't. They just leave their body. And they get tired of it. That's why they do. Because when the body is not working well, then it's tiring. And we live in a very toxic environment. The food system is very bad. The medical system is very bad. The pollution of the elements is very bad. So our bodies don't last that necessarily that well. But then they go on, Cheapest method of rejuvenation and most effective is to die and find a nice womb and be reborn. That's the cheapest method. So you should be happy for your dad. And I'm sure he loved you a lot, and I'm sure he was probably only hanging in probably from 75 to 87 for your sake. Then he decided you would make it and be the cheery person that you are. Look at you. You have a flower in your hair, you have nice tattoos on your shoulders. You're Mrs. Cheerful. That's very nice. So relax. You say you quit your job as what? As bartending, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a really good job. Because people are getting unhealthy doing it, You're dishing it to them. So it's not actually, it's not a rewarding thing. Although you can be kind and nice to them in some way, and that can be helpful. And some of them maybe will go and find a shrink who will tell them something they don't want to hear. So you're going to find something better, I'm sure. Teacher or something. Anyway, Anyway, I'm so happy you came here today.
Oh, you're so nice.
This past weekend. It's really nice. I hope you keep doing it.
Of course. I'll
and, you know, I'm going to pursue you after you retire. But we still have plenty of time. Mm. I'm going to pursue you after you retire. We'll make a study thing here, I think. Mm-hmm. Build another building or something. Mm-hmm. Make a study. Get that crazy psychodynamic guy. What's his name?
Which guy?
Michael, your friend.
Oh, Miller? Michael? Yeah, yeah.
He always wants to join.
Yeah.
But he's too dynamic for me.
Yeah.
He scares me.
Yeah.
I'm not dynamic enough. But he's great. He's a
yeah,
good guy.
Yeah, he's great.
He is great.
Yeah.
So
Michael Vincent Miller.
So that's the thing. You want to read this one?
Yeah, you read.
Oh, you want me to read?
Okay.
This is written in the 18th century.
Yeah, end of the 18th century. An enlightenment poem of a Mongolian Lama, Jangkhya, how do you say, Jangkhya
Rolway? Jangkhya Rolway Dorje.
Jangkhya.
And Rolway Dorje means the playful Vajra.
Right.
And a Vajra is it's a scepter, can be, but what it really means, it can mean diamond, and it can mean thunderbolt, and it basically means clear light, infinite energy, clear light. And it can also mean a phallus, actually, in a very esoteric level.
Hmm. Isn't it also symbolic?
Rolwa means playful. Hmm. Rolwe Dorje, playful.
Isn't Vajra also anger transformed? Isn't it sometimes?
Not necessarily.
So much. Okay.
Anger, lust, confusion,
everything.
Pride, envy, all negative things are just
right.
Misappropriations, misdirections of this infinite basic energy of the universe.
Okay.
Something like that, which is really love. Meaning that it fulfills every need. It can fulfill every need, that thing.
So this is his enlightenment song, in the aftermath of his enlightenment.
What's that?
In the aftermath of his enlightenment, he composes.
Well, I guess. I don't know. You'll see.
Okay.
It's complicated.
It's called Song of Mother Emptiness, translated by Tenzin Bob Thurman.
I translated it when my mother died, actually, the first time. Hmm. And read it at her funeral.
Really?
Yeah, that was the beginning of my notorious history at funerals,
mm-hmm.
where, I never went really to a proper Irish wake, but I like cultures where they're celebratory at funerals.
Mm-hmm.
They should be, instead of all mopey and weird, everyone feels they're supposed to do that, so they do,
How did it go over?
There's even a thing, that thing in the Book of the Dead, there's a thing, in the Book of the Dead, that warns you. It's you read it to the person who passed, and you warn them. You say, "Look, when after you die, and you still hang around, and then you recover your natural human ability to read everybody else's mind, because you become like a field rather than a boundary thing, and you're not shut down by blocks. And so, when you go to your own funeral." And, of course, you'll notice your own body, and you go and even wonder who it is, or maybe if you don't get into where you're trying to get back into it, that won't work. But the one thing is, don't be pissed off when you read the mind of some relative who's going, "Oh, Bob, I'm so sad. Oh, what are we going to do without him? You're such a great guy." And then you're reading the underneath mind saying, "Good riddance, that bum. Like, I'm so sick of him, like, making jokes at me and blah, blah, blah." And just don't be mad. Everybody has multiple levels of thought in their mind, and you normally don't notice them, but now you will. So don't be mad. And when the priest who's conducting the funeral is only thinking about the beer and the burger they're going to have when the damn thing is over, and they're going blah, 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 but they don't care at all about it. And don't be mad at the priest. That's just the way people are.
Did you read Lincoln and the Bardo yet?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
I got to read that. Who wrote that?
George Saunders.
George who?
Saunders.
Saunders, okay.
You know George Saunders?
S-A-U?
Yeah.
Okay, Lincoln and the Bardo.
He's a Buddhist novelist.
I saw the movie Lincoln the Vampire.
No, Lincoln and the Bardo. No, it's so good, Lincoln and the Bardo.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, sorry.
Song of Mother Emptiness by Jangkhya Rolway Dorje. Translated by Tenzin Bob Thurman, read for the first time at his mother's funeral. O thatness of profound relativity, O wonder, may the guru who nakedly reveals this as it is, his kindness irrepayable, be enthroned in my heart. I will speak spontaneously whatever comes to mind. This is 2 centuries before Freud. I will speak spontaneously whatever comes to mind. I was like a mad child, long lost his old mother, never could find her though she was with him always. But now it seems I'm about to find that kind old Amma. Amma is like a nurse or mother. Now it seems I'm about to find that kind old Amma, since Big Brother relativity hints where she hides. I think, yes, yes, then no, no, then could it be really? These various subjects and objects are mother's smiling face. These births, deaths, and changes are mother's lying words. The undeceiving mother has deceived me. My only hope of refuge is in brother relativity. But the sole chance for freedom is just old mother's love. If this subject-object situation were all there was, the 3-time Buddhas could find no way to save us. But liberation is possible, since these various changes are but the changes of the unchanging mother. The mutual interdependence of ineffable mother where nothing has status and relativity where everything appears is exactly what must be understood. Seeking my old father and just not finding is the actual finding of my old mother. Then from my mother's lap I find my old father. I, child of such kind parents, cry out for their refuge. When mother's neither one nor many face seems to be there ineffably reflected in the clear mirror of Big Brother relativity, how crazy I was not to start this quest. The generous testaments of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti were but papers blown away by the wind until Tsongkhapa, Manjusri's essence, sent his retriever hawk to get them. Then was I saved the trials of far questing and allowed to see my old mother, natural, here with me. Nowadays, some of the bright ones of our school, fond of terms such as self-sufficiency and truth status, seem to put aside what obviously appears before them and seek some fabulous unicorn to be critiqued. They never acknowledge this obvious appearance. They explain and explain, not hitting the crux, and that old mother completely escapes them. Though things surely do exist somehow, their reality seems not to be this horny incompatibility, since the intimacy of father-mother union seems inseparably tender and cozy. You want me to go on?
I think skip that. It's okay. Too complicated because no one will appreciate it.
He's critiquing.
But there's this other one here.
Yeah, it goes at the end. It's nice.
At the end. I think that this just from here, though, from though.
Though by no means am I an heir to omniscience, through skill with the reins of analysis and devotion, I rode well the fine stallion of the ancestral texts and won our freedom from the dangerous abyss. No need to seek her, she's the seeker himself. Don't cling to her truth, she is utter falsehood. Don't negate her falseness, it is truth itself. It's sufficient to rest in the unabsolute, unceased. Though I don't see my mother, by her mere name it seems I encounter the long-lost kind parents, as if in face-to-face confrontation. Great thanks, O Nagarjuna and sons. Great thanks, O Tsongkhapa Lama. Great thanks, O kind Guru Lama. As the way to repay all your kindness, I thus honor our mother, emptiness. My unproduced, inexpressible old mother cradles gently the tiny infant of intellect. With the banquet of her perfectly good expressions, may she lead all beings to true happiness. Imala, Rolwe Dorje. That's like a praise, I think. Aola, my dance of joy. Ahola, honor the 3 gems.
Thank you. I like that one. You like that yourself?
I love that myself.
It's because it's personal, you know.
It's both personal
and... He was, you know, these lamas have a difficult life because in a way they're taken from their parents at a young age. But they kind of don't mind, actually. And the parents also don't mind. They feel honored. And they are exceptional as children, actually, always, usually. There's all kind of weird phenomena happen when they're born. And he became the teacher of the longest-serving Manchu emperor in the 18th century and did tremendous great works in China and Tibet and Mongolia, keeping peace and things, and working with the 7th and 8th Dalai Lamas. He was their close colleague, but he was their person in Beijing, that type of thing, and making sure that some court intrigues and things didn't come down in a bad way on the Tibetans, all through the 18th century. It's a remarkable person, really. I love it.
Can you explain?
My old Mongolian teacher insisted I had to really read this.
Yeah, I love this thing. Can you explain about the mother emptiness?
What?
Explain about the mother emptiness.
Well, it's all these wonderful things, you know. The thatness, oh, thatness of profound relativity. You know, thatness means that kind of thing, you know, when you're in a certain state and you see things and each one of them is like a jewel or it's like infinity or something like that, you know, that expression. And that's the thatness of the thing. It's like, I think Meister Eckhart, the great mystic, Western mystic, he called it Istigkeit, isness of things. You know? And then there's two kinds. There's suchness and thatness, which are not the same. Many people translate them as the same thing, but they're not. Thatness is when you have a sense of the nirvana in the specific phenomenon, you know, that you see, that it is nirvana as itself. So you have non-duality in the relative thing. And suchness is where the relative thing, in non-duality, is the relative thing sort of pointing to the absolute, you know, clear light of the void.
There's a poet named Wallace Stevens who lived from 1879 to 1955, whose first book was tremendously influential on the great poets of his age. And he didn't assume a persona the way other poets did. He worked as an insurance executive. He'd walk to work, and as he did so, he'd compose a poem in his mind and come to work, take off his coat, pick up the dictating machine, and say to his secretary, "I'd like you to take down the idea of order at Key West," and he'd speak the poem. He was never quite popular. Also, besides his lack of self-promotion, because he had a sophisticated vocabulary with sometimes an upper-class tone. His wife posed for the Liberty Dime. But enough of that. I'd like to read a poem written, I think it was 1917, in that first book of poems of his. 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. 1. Among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. 2. I was of 3 minds, like a tree in which there are 3 blackbirds. 3. The blackbird whirled in the autumn winds. It was a small part of the pantomime. 4. A man and a woman are one. A man and a woman and a blackbird are one. 5. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling or just after. Six. Icicles filled the long window with barbaric glass. The shadow of the blackbird crossed it to and fro. The mood traced in the shadow an indecipherable cause. Seven. O thin men of Haddam, why do you imagine golden birds? Do you not see how the blackbird walks around the feet of the women about you? Eight. I know noble accents and lucid, inescapable rhythms. But I know, too, that the blackbird is involved in what I know. Nine. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. Ten. At the sight of blackbirds flying in a green light, even the bawds of euphony would cry out sharply. 11. He rode over Connecticut in a glass coach. Once a fear pierced him in that he mistook the shadow of his equipage for blackbirds. 12. The river is moving. The blackbird must be flying. 13. It was evening all afternoon. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. The blackbird sat in the cedar limb. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.